My name is Father John. I probably have not met all of you, but I serve at the Hundoa Mission here at the Hundoa Monastery. And sometimes give talks when asked, seems like you, or answer questions. So, what Father Timothy had set up with us is to have a little, just a little talk and then a discussion time interaction. So you should feel free to ask questions and along the lines of what we talk about or whatever other questions you might have in mind and questions about the monastery and things like that. The suggestion was that we talk a little bit about vocation. You call it what the Christian life is all about and how to sort of get some guidance in it for what we ought to do with our lives. And so I'll start and then Mother will talk a short time, maybe 15 minutes, and then Mother will talk and then we'll have discussion time, okay? So I want to start at the beginning in Genesis, and I think of it in a pretty simple-minded way that God created the world and got through 5.5 days, and he looked around and said, well, this is beautiful, but where do I live? Where's my home? And you might think, well, God's everywhere, so the whole world is his home, but there's still something missing because there had not yet created through 5.5 days anything that could respond to his love with love. Everything that he had created through 5.5 days was not free in the sense of having human freedom or divine freedom. And so he could love the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and the forest, and they could respond the way that birds and fish and forests respond, which we know from the Psalms is glorifying God. But they couldn't respond volitionally. They couldn't say, I love you, Lord, in the way that a free human being could, and by which I mean we could also say, I reject you, I turn the other way. And so by his home, what I mean when he's looking for a home is that, God is love, and love requires a response. And so God created human beings in his image, and when he did that, he said, let us create man in our image. And so Orthodox think of that statement from Genesis as being a reference to the Holy Trinity, and that human beings are created to be fundamentally social or relational creatures. We're not just like little atoms that bounce around in the world or billiard balls. We are connected to one another. God told Adam when he created him, it's not good for man to be alone. You weren't created to be alone. You were created to be connected to other people. So we're ultimately, human beings are created for community with one another, but really ultimately with God. And our relationship to God is his home. He takes up residence in us. Okay, so that's kind of simple. But if you think about, well, what should I do with my life? Whatever age, maybe you're little, maybe you're old, whatever, what should you do with your life? Well, you should be God's home. that's simple. And there's really no other calling in life other than to be God's home and to sort of fulfill what it is that you were created for, which is to be his residence. So we have all of these images throughout Scripture, but especially in the New Testament that Christ abides in us. He wants his word to abide in us and that our body is the temple. There's a lot of images of ourselves, our bodies being the temple of God. The temple is the place where God lives. And so this is really our calling. And what happened with Adam and Eve is that, we're coming upon a fast, so we could just sort of say this very briefly. So there was a fig tree, that's how it's usually said in Orthodoxy, in the hymnography or in the Fathers, that God said, you can eat anything in the garden, but don't eat from this tree here, the fig tree, okay? And they did, and what happened? Well, you think, well, just eating a fig, what's the big deal? Well, the fig was there because they had a chance to say, Lord, I love you more than figs. It's really that simple. And often we think that fasting occurs because, well, we have all these passions and we can't control ourselves. But fasting started before the fall. Adam and Eve were asked to fast. It had anything to do with the fall or overcoming passions. Adam and Eve, fasting is grounded in creation, not in redemption. there is a role for fasting in helping us overcome our passions. That's a different talk. But the real gift that God gave us when he put a tree there that said, I want simply you to be able to show me that you love me more than the things of the world, more than creation. That's how St. Paul puts it in Romans 1. And so the idea is simply we could choose to reject God or we can choose to respond to him. And Adam and Eve chose to reject him. And it turns out that what difference does it make if it's just a little fig? And it turns out to make a big difference because really it's the rejection of God. And that's a big deal. So I don't want to talk a lot about fasting, but you know, sometimes we're kind of careless with fasting. Like, oh, what difference does it make if I eat some cheese or eat a hot dog or eat whatever? But really what we're doing is telling God, no, I love you more than I love these things of the world. And so we're taking ourselves and offering ourselves to God. And so in this way, Adam and Eve rejected being the home of God. That's what they did. God said, I want to be your home. They said, no, we prefer the things of the world. And the way that St. Paul puts it is that we prefer the creation over the creator. That's the bottom line. We prefer the things of this world, our reputation, our job, our money, our pleasure, organizing our life, taking control of things, whatever it is. We prefer all of those things over God. And if we have some time left over at the end, well, maybe God can sit in, but he's not the center. And so the Christian life after the fall is this sort of return. It's the good shepherd coming for us. You know, God comes through the garden calling out, Adam, where are you? But that's just Jesus saying that he came to seek and save the lost. He comes searching for us. The good shepherd searches for the lost sheep. And so everything in our Christian life is God calling. My sheep hear my voice and they know me and they follow me. I lead them out and they follow me. So everything in the Christian life is initiated by God and we're responding. So you don't have to go work hard about trying to figure out, oh, what should I do and how hard should I work on this or that? It's like, no, we should just try to respond to God when we hear his call. And sometimes that's just in our conscience, or maybe we're reading the scriptures or hearing a homily or whatever it is. We respond to those ways in which God calls us. And by doing that, we're placing ourselves in his presence and letting him come inhabit us or enliven us. He inhabits us from baptism on, but he sort of activates or enlivens his life in us because we're cooperating with him. He initiates and we respond. And so the biggest overarching threat about our calling in this life is to be God's home. And in the fallen world, that's to simply respond to his initiation in whatever way. And all of the commands that were given in Scripture are really just commands of love. We have that in tomorrow's gospel that there's only two commandments, to love the Lord your God with your whole being and to love your neighbor as yourself. And well, how about all the other commands? And St. Paul says all of the other commands are fulfilled in love. Love fulfills the whole law. So if there's something like command like don't gossip, well, that's the way you love in that context. Or to encourage one another, that's how you love God in that context. And don't eat excessively, or don't be given to idle talk, or all of these just are different ways to love God or to love our neighbor in certain contexts. And so we're responding to God's invitation to love us when we are obedient to the commands, because the commands are just an invitation to tell us where life is found. They're invitations to say, this is where we commune together. And if we deviate from those, if we say, no, I don't want to be kind to this person, I want to retaliate, they were unkind to me, I want to be unkind back, well, then we separate ourselves from God in that way. You know, we don't turn the other cheek or go the extra mile. We, instead of returning good for evil, return evil for evil. And when we do that, we think, well, maybe we're justified, whatever that means. But in fact, we're deviating or we're turning away from God in that context, because he invites us to be ones who break this practice of, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You poke my eye out, I'm going to poke your eye out. It's sort of economic relationships. It's we do to others as they do to us. Not as we don't do to others as we would want them to do us, but we do to others as they do to us. And so we live in this sort of economy of relationships. And Christ asks us to break that, and we can break that because our source of life is from him. And so anyways, in the broad the broad scheme of things, this is what we're called to, is this communion with God where he comes to inhabit us. And the thing next thing I want to say about that is that a lot of us are inclined to think that we have to fix our lives up so that God can move in. And so it's like he buys fixer-uppers. We're told that he purchases us, he redeemed us, he purchases us, and then he doesn't move in right away. He takes out all the old crud and cleans and brings in some new things, and then he can move in. But that's not how it works. Maybe that's how we would buy a house and fix it up. But he moves in our baptism, chrismation, he moves in, and he's the one who fixes us up from the inside out. And so, again, our cooperation with that is simply us letting him have his way with us. And so we're growing up to look like him, into his likeness. And so if he inhabits us, he'll come to shine forth out of us. The light that shines out of us will be his light, not ours. And so I think that's what we always should keep in mind. Think, well, should I be a plumber or a lawyer or a nurse or a school teacher? And the answer, or monastic or married or whatever these things are, and the big picture is you should be a Christian. you should follow Christ. You should be his home. That's there's no occupation or no calling in life that supersedes being Christ's home, taking his dwelling in you. You can be really successful in all different kinds of ways in the world, in the church. The Pharisees were very successful in Judaism, but they wouldn't have any interest at all in being Christ's home. And so that's really, anything that gets in the way of that or gets ahead of that is putting something in creation ahead of the Creator. And however excited or enthusiastic you get about being the choir director, teaching Sunday school, all those are great things. Do those things. But if it feeds your ego and you get upset at people because they didn't thank you for it, or they corrected you and you got retaliated with, well, yeah, but look, lash back at them, well, then our lives are out of balance, because none of that really matters if Christ is the center of our life. We're going to get criticized, and that's okay, and Christ will use all that for good. So all of the things that we think about are so important in our lives, they're important, but their importance is subject to Christ being the center of our life, that relationship with him. And that gets cultivated, by simple prayers, by keeping the fast, by coming to church, by having Holy Communion, by coming to confession. And the simple ways that are so kind of common and practical that maybe we forget how important and valuable they are. But, if you didn't eat any food for weeks and weeks, you wouldn't be very healthy. And if you didn't sleep for weeks and weeks, you wouldn't be very healthy. And there are certain things that you just do to take care of your physical body. And you don't have to dwell on them, but you need them. The same thing in the spiritual life. There's these things that we do. If we don't do them, then we start drifting away. We start forgetting about Christ and that sort of centrality. So that's the big thing. Now, on the one step down is from that is, well, okay, but we have to make decisions in life. Should I marry this person or that person? Or should I, pursue this degree or that degree? Or should I retire now or later? there's all different stages in our life, and the decisions that are before us are different at those different stages of life. And I think that one thing that matters a lot to me is to don't try to figure it out. First, you say, Lord, this is your life. I want to offer my life to you. We say that prayer all the time in the services. Let us, remembering our most holy Theotokos and all the saints, and let us offer ourselves and one another in our whole life. So we just want to offer our life to God. And then, on offering our life to God, we say, Lord, you open and close the doors. I can't figure this out. I'm not going to sit in the corner and wait till lightning strikes. I'm going to move forward. And the slogan there is that God steers moving ships. So if you're moving, if you're going somewhere, then God will steer you if you really want to take him with you. You might think, well, should I be a nurse or a school teacher? And, well, maybe God has a thought about that and he'll open and close doors for you. But from our point of view, if you're going to be a school teacher and leave God at home, then, well, that's not a good thing. But if you're going to be a school teacher and take God with you, well, that's a good thing. Same thing with being a nurse. If you're going to be a nurse and you leave God at home, then that's not a good thing. But if you're going to be a nurse and take God with you, by which I mean, you know, you bring Christ into that setting, you pray, you're praying for the people that you're teaching or the offering nursing care to or whatever it is. And that your occupation is being a mother at home and taking care of kids. If you're going to do that by your own strength, well, then you're no longer really living as God's home. But if you're bringing Christ with you and you're raising the kids or the grandkids or pursuing this activity or hobby or helping out in community things, then you're bringing Christ with you. And if you're bringing Christ with you, that's how Christ will steer the moving ship. If you stay at home and do nothing, maybe lightning will strike and you'll know what to do. But I don't think that's how it normally works. We say we offer ourselves to God and then we just move forward. And this can happen in all different sorts of ways. And Father Timothy had mentioned a couple of things. He said, well, people are wondering what saint's name to have. You know, you're a catechumen, you're going to be chrismated. Like, what saint should I pick? Or how do I pick godparents? And I sort of think the same thing. It's like, well, you say, Lord, I don't know what to do. So here, you show me. And then you move forward. And maybe you move forward by reading some saints' lives or asking around. And I think of those cases as a little different, but different parishes do different things. So when you were given a name by your parents when you were born, you didn't have any say in the matter. Your parents didn't say, well, we should wait till they're 7 and see what name they want to have. Like, that's just not how it works. And in some threads of orthodoxy, that's how getting a name at chrismation works. Like, why would you choose your own name? Your name's given to you. And so the priest or whatever baptizing you, chrismating you, will give you a name. And so you could say to your priest, I want you to pick out the name. And sometimes it'll go like this. I know some people, when they have been tonsured a monastic and you get a new name, the person tonsuring them will say, well, give me 3 names and I'll pick one. And so there's some kind of interaction, but it's not my will, right? I'm not the one who chooses my name. So on the issue of names, I think you might want to think about saying, well, okay, I have these thoughts and opinions, but I really want to be given the name. You don't have to do that. Again, there's wide practice, and it's not like you're not a heretic if you do some of the approach. But on the issue of getting names, names are given, usually, and granted, and not chosen. And so I think that's a good thing. But for other things, godparents, there's somebody who's made a little bit of influence in your life, in the life of the parish, or you're getting to know. And the main thing is not to overthink these things, because God will turn it into good. Well, it happens in all kinds of ways. When my wife and I first came here for a week as visitors, I was a deacon. We just came here because my family's lived nearby. That was it. But we never left. So we left for a little bit, but then we came back. And it wasn't the plan. We didn't think we were going to be here. And we were just coming to visit my mother and my wife's parents. And my wife's from Saginaw. So we were Saginaw and we were in Elgin and we came here. But I think that's just a particular instance of a moving ship. We were moving in our lives in a certain direction. It wasn't here. It was Vermont. That was pretty clear. We were already had moved to Vermont, in fact. But if you take your life and say, Lord, I want you to do something with it, and we're responsive, and doors open and doors close, and you just follow the open doors, then it works out okay. And that's as true with picking godparents as it is with picking careers or whatever it is, because God loves us too much to let us go by the wayside. He's not going to let us fall down and not be able to get back up. It's just a matter if we want to respond to him. So for me, I we all have to face these things, but for me, the big picture is always, don't get bent out of shape about anything other than becoming Christ-like, being his home, letting him dwell in me. You can get angry or upset or get your feathers ruffled about all kinds of things, but as soon as you remember that you're going to stand before the last judgment seat and you're going to be a sheep or a goat, everything else comes into relief. Like, and everything else falls away. Nothing else is very important compared to that communion with God. And then, in all of the other events of life, I think that God opens and closes doors if we offer himself to him. And he'll guide us in tangible ways. And maybe some people get a vision or feel or hear a certain kind of inner voice, and that's okay, but that I don't think that that's necessary. There's just it's kind of a yearning, a growing desire, a sense that I don't want to leave this particular path, and we follow that. And if God wants to divert us elsewhere, he will, if we're responsive to him. So I think that's how I think of this, whether the issues are big and important, seemingly important in world's eyes, like what job or career you're going to have or who you're going to marry or if you're going to become a monastic, but also just kind of like day-to-day mundane things as well, that you just offer it to God. I mean, sometimes I say, well, should I go into town today to do these errands? And I just have a conversation with God, say, God, I really don't want to go into town today, but these things have to get done. And you just go back and forth, and you offer it to God, and then whatever happens, happens. Because the only thing that really matters is you take God with you, whether you stay at home or whether you go into town and do errands. But you have to have that conversation, and then you feel okay about it and good about it. And that'll be true with your godparents, the name that you get, and the career that you choose, and the person that you marry, and children that you raise. And that's my two cents.
Well, since you're at the monastery, and sometimes there are people even people who grew up in the Orthodox Church, and maybe they say, wonder what is a monastery, who are the monastics, where they come from? And I grew up in an Orthodox country, and I never asked myself probably where did they come from. I thought they were just always there, right? But that's one way that one thing that God calls some people, and there was always throughout the history of mankind, there is a small percentage of people that are called to the monastic life. So how do we know that? That's where you say a vocation. Of course, we talk about vocation in different ways. So Father explained whether really our basic vocation is for everybody, regardless of what we do or what titles we have or type of education or talent. It's a matter of God gives us. And then you do that, you know, and to the glory of God. In obedience to the will of God. Obedience is key. It's not only a monastic vow. Obedience is for everyone. If we love one another, we want to help or be of use or ask, how can I help? And that's where God's instruments, you know, his legs, his hands, his whatever. So he said, here I am, God. Here I am, Lord. And of course, the Virgin Mary is that perfect example that when Gabriel came to her to give her the news that she will be the one to bear Christ. So she says, here's your servant, Lord. Be to me according to thy will. Yes, this is what we do. Be unto me according to thy will. So some, and some are, we call them monastics. And of course, that is development throughout the history of Christianity, that monastics were those who just, went away from the world, maybe in a quiet place up in the mountains at the edge of the city, and then into the desert and all that, to live a prayer of life with less cares. Okay, and as St. Paul talks about, you know, if someone is married or care for a woman or care for her husband, the husband will care for her, you know, for his wife, that the one who is not married will care for God alone. That's where it comes from. So first of all is someone who feels and knows. God speaks to us through our conscience. It gives us the good thought of what we should do. God gives us talents. And we know, I can do this, I think I can do that. And we always say, and even we have children, we says, oh, I like to do that, I like to do that. I would like to become a doctor, I'd like to be an engineer, I'd like to build ships, whatever it is. So it's the same. We have that because it's God speaking to us, our conscience, okay? We have that sense of right and wrong. So we know God gave us intelligence. God gave us talents. There's all these attributes that God has put into us, so we do something with them. And whatever that is, we do it, we give it back to God, actually. This way. Everything that we do is what God has given us, we give it back to God. Okay? It's in the parable of the talents. Okay, try to multiply those talents and offer them back to God. So when we'll see, when we face God at the last judgment, he will say, what have you done with the talent I gave you? So we don't want to say, well, Lord, I buried that. It was just one. What am I going to do with that? Okay? So we don't want to say that. We say, this is what I did. So those are the ones who know, have a notion of, like, this is what my calling is. This is what I should do in life. Be monastic, which is a life of, mostly a life of prayer, of dedication to God and the world in that respect. First of all, by not getting married. Okay? So that's first thing, and it's clear. If you're going to be a monastic, it means you renounce family life. Being married, having children, that's the first renunciation, that's called the vow of chastity, and some one aspect of it, that is. And then, of course, a vow of poverty, which means I don't possess any material things. Okay, we see in the monastery here, oh, the beautiful church and the grounds and the buildings and everything else. And we have, you name it, we have it. Okay, basically, we have cars, we have gas, we have a banking account, of course, but it's not mine. It doesn't belong to any of us. It's the community. Okay, it's for the community, it's for the good of everyone and those who come here. So I don't have it, I don't have my own car. I don't have, if I to leave the monastery, this monastery, tomorrow, I'm going to take my clothes because they fit me and my shoes because they don't fit anybody else, right? And something like that, that's all I have, maybe a couple of icons and a couple of books. That's all I say that I possess. And even those, I should be ready, willing and ready to give them away, basically. So that's the attitude, that's what a monastic is. And then, we don't ask, you know, how much am I going to be paid, you know, for cooking today, or for mopping the floor, or for working in the garden, whatever we do, we're working in the gift shop, or anything of that. We don't have a salary, we don't ask how much, we just don't. So it's that way of life. We trust God completely that He will provide if we're totally dedicated to Him, and what we do is to be for the glory of God and for the good of the church and the people of God. So this is what it is. And then the vow of obedience, because we all are obedient to God. It's very important because obedience is freedom. Okay, I do God's will. That comes to me through my superior, my older brother, my younger sister, my neighbor, however it comes. So it's a matter of what can I do for you? I live for you and not for myself. We all should be able to say, I live for God, but not for myself. Maybe it sounds very difficult. Maybe it's just, yes, but what about me, okay? So, and Father Roman always says, a good Christian never says I and me, but what about me? It's always about you. It's always about the other person, the one who is in front of me. Because this is how I am saved. By doing, by offering, by being there for someone else, not for myself. If it's just for myself, sure, I can do it, and then what? It stays there. It's like you bury the talent, the treasure. You bury it. It doesn't grow. For the grain of wheat to sprout for new life, it has to be buried in the ground, which means you're cutting your will. Okay, you offer it, so it springs forth life. It's important, and on the other more practical maybe aspect of it, what is the place of monastics in the church, to say. The Orthodox Church is such rich, it's a liturgical life. It's life of asceticism. It's a night of giving, of offering, of an effort. It's work. And in so many ways. And the liturgical life of the Orthodox Church is so rich, it's so full. Okay, so if you remember the time of the apostles, the Christians were small groups, okay? And they would live in community. They share everything in common. They'll get up in the morning and they pray together, and then they go do their work. And at the end of the day, they'll come together, pray together, share a meal together, and go to rest, and that was their life. Well, there is spread, and they can do that. You did not have those rural communities, the people still lived in community. But then it did spread out, and then we have parish communities. So we still have communities at large. Maybe you don't live like in a communal, but the idea and the ideal of having a community is still there. Okay, well, it developed and spread in such a way that every parish doesn't do services every day as a community. There's some here and there, some priests that may go to church and do, you know, prayers. You may find in the Orthodox countries or in the large cities, churches being open all day, and there's a priest there all the time, and they may do an Ekkatis or a Parakletos or something. People come in and venerate or ask for confession or for prayers, and they go on and so. So there's still that connection with the church. But then, it says, as the church developed and grew, and so monasticism grew, it became more, a little bit more like, this is the role and this is the offering of the monastics, to really keep that liturgical life of the church alive and active every single day. So we have those books there in the church that have hymns and services and canons every single day of the year, for morning and evening. So this is what really the contribution, that we say, or the direct offering of the monastics is, pray for themselves, but to pray for the world, and to keep the life of the prayer life of the church alive and active, and said, that's really as it is, and it is functions nowadays. And it's important that everyone in the church is aware of it and don't struggle alone. And my Father John always brings that, and I think he brings it for me, reminding me, don't struggle alone. Don't think that you're going to do it by yourself. No, we're not. We're together. So I need to be aware that you people are there struggling on your own way, doing the work that I don't do. And then you are aware that there are monastics there that do something that I don't do. They offer something I can't offer. And this is what it is. We're just aware. So we're connected. And that's a connection. That's a true connection, a true communion in prayer. As you get up in the morning and one thought comes to you, Lord, there's monastics somewhere that will do matters of liturgy today. I can't do that, but they're praying for me too. So just have the, you know, that blessing of their effort, you know, come with me and bless my day today. That's it. That's all I need to do. And we have people who come to the monastery, and then after they leave, every so often we hear from somebody, since I visited the monastery, I'm so aware every day at 5 o'clock when I return from work that you are doing Vespers. The connection is right there. So this is what it is. And that's our life in Christ. Maybe you are not physically together in one place, and I don't think God meant it that way, because he says, he sent the apostles out there, go and preach, right? Go and tell the world the good works that God has done unto you, all the good things God has done unto you. And this is what we do. We're spread out there, yet all connected and all together, you know, in prayer and the praise of God, one for another, our offerings, wherever we are. We know that's the life of the saints also, and this is how the saints help us. We just celebrate the St. Nectarius. Oh my goodness, the pilgrimage is hundreds and thousands of people who go to, you know, to Aegina, or, you know, wherever their relics, his relics are, and it seems like he's everywhere. St. John of San Francisco, you know, since then, Shanghai or San Francisco, whatever we want to call it, St. John Maximovich. I hear so many people that they feel his presence, he's there. You just call, and he's there. You just call the saints, and they're there. Not physically, but you know, we know, because we're spiritual beings. Sometimes we don't see in front of us if we're, you know, our minds are raised up to God. We don't not necessarily notice everything that is around us, and it's the other way around. When we're so tied to the earth and to the material things, we forget that there's you know, another world, that is the spiritual world, that is heaven, that we are spiritual beings and eternal beings, not just material beings. So the life of, you know, this material aspect of our life, it should be just to help us in our salvation, help us on the way to heaven, not to hold us back from that. Because it's actually it's much better. It's much more joyful than being stressed about this and that and the other. But we live in the world, and not everyone is, you know, maybe not everyone yes is a Christian, or not everyone. We fall and we get up, right? That is strive and to remain focused and to have that experience. So I would say if anyone has the question come to their mind, should I become a monastic? What if? Maybe I should. Okay, I always say, pay attention to it and do something about it. Maybe it's God speaking to you, or whatever. So that's one thing, and you find out. Sure, there could be different reasons. You know, sometimes it's, oh, this life is so hard, I just gotta be monastic, I forget about it. Well, I'm not sure if that's a real, okay, desire. God can turn things around. Okay, somebody has a bad relationship or something that's in their car, and think, I better go be a monastic. And sometimes that worked out too. Maybe it's a moment that God calls. And then there are those who, you know, sincere children raised up in the faith and in the church and can see. And that's important. I say for those of you who have children and are in the community, we should encourage our children to sincerely guide them, okay, to see what talents they have. What would God have for them do in their life so they're fulfilled? Okay, so they're happy, they're fulfilled, they're accomplished, not in the society we live in, accomplished in as God's people, you know, that what that is. And I don't know, I bring an example, my mother and with my brother, because I was and the youngest, and my older brother, and one was older than me, became a priest. And I remember, I was old enough to remember that when it was time for him to choose where to go to school, she says, you know, maybe you can, she didn't say, that's where you should go. She didn't say, what about, did you think of, how do you think, and should we look at, maybe you'd like to study seminary. Maybe you'd go to the seminary. You know, we think we can try, okay, well, see and visit the talk. And he did, and he is a priest, now he is retired. But then as I grew older and the question came to me so many times, how do you choose or how do you know? I remember my mother saying that, one time I asked my mother, I said, I have three brothers. So I said, why did you suggest to him that he goes tries seminary? And she said to me, oh, didn't you see that he's just different than the other boys? They're all good and they all have talents, but he was just different than the other. It seemed like that's the wisdom of a parent, of a good, loving parent, that he knows the inclinations, the gifts, the abilities that a child has, and he can encourage that way. Okay, is God calling this for the priesthood? Or for the monastic life, something else. And I hear parents many times say, oh, not that one, he's not good for monastic, not that's that boy of mine, no, he's not good for a priest. So you see, it's that gift that God puts in within us, that we know. It's that wisdom that comes from God, and we say it, and we notice. Okay, so this is how it is. So we see children with that, and we raise them in the faith and in the church, and allow God to choose that. And parents pray that their children would, you know, God chooses for them and shows you and them what the plan is, what, you know, God's plan is for them in life. So that's basically, in a few words, how we know, how we can say it. So, but on the other hand, yes, flourish where you're put, right? Wherever you're planted, try to flourish there, bring fruit, bring, you know, harvest wherever God plants us. It's not good to say, well, I wish I would have done this, or I'm here, but I wish I was there. That's not a good attitude. That's not a good attitude, no. Because you're neither here nor there. That's what we call that as a temptation. To say, well, this life is so hard, maybe I should have done that. You know, I should go there, I shouldn't be here, I shouldn't have done this, I should. You know, if this is what it is, then you should do it. Move on and do change your life if this is what it is. But being neither here nor there, it's a temptation. Because that God, the devil really doesn't want us to do anything good, to succeed, to be fulfilled, to be grateful, always, forever ungrateful for what we have, for what we do, because we should have done something else. It's not a good attitude. So, that's my 2 cents.
Now you have
that
four
makes
cents.
4 cents. You see, it's multiplying. Anyway, coming to the monastery, you know, you have pilgrims today, right? You have pilgrims. That means you made an effort. You would get up earlier than usual on a Saturday morning, and even the children I have. I always ask children and teens especially, like, you like to sleep in on Saturday morning. And some girl says, yeah, you know, I sleep till noon. On Saturday, I sleep till noon. You know, it's the day that can... But you made an effort today, and there's the other ones. You know, made an effort today to get up a little bit earlier than maybe your usual Saturday time to get up, to get on the bus and to get here. God will reward. Says that the tradition says that God, our guardian angel really counts every step we have we take to do God's will and to go to church and go there. So it is an effort that God will bless. And you will just have to be aware, you know, grateful for that. So it is wonderful. So when we go to a monastery, it's basically to remove ourselves from our familiar routine and environment so we can see, we can think, we can put those things aside and give a little bit of a break to our minds, to our souls in a different way. So when we, and that, if that, that should be every time we go to church, that we enter God's time. We enter eternity. Just forget. We live in a society that is so, I don't know, tense, and have run here, run there, this, we have 5 minutes, I have 10 minutes, I have to get to a disappointment. Okay, I have to run home, I have to do this, and I'm like, phew. Although you see, our life here at the monastery is very more structured. Yes, we get up at some time, and go to church, and prayers, and the meals, and the work, and all that, so it's all structured, but don't try to have it so stressful. If it's stressing, it means something is not right. Oh, you work hard? Yes, I think you should work hard. Have we ever worked too hard for God? I don't think any of us can really say that, because that's a different type of experience. When you do it out of love and you know, you enjoy doing it, and you see, you know God's grace. But nevertheless, so every so often, so when we go to church, we should forget about everything. We enter eternity. We enter God's time, and He is eternal. Nothing. Everything remains out there. Just forget about everything. Just be there. And it's the same type of experience when one comes to the monastery. That's, you know, the main reason, I think, if we realize it or not, sometimes we just need to just remove ourselves or go. And that's what it is. Just be present there. Just forget. Give your soul a little respite, a little rest. Just don't worry about anything. Just enter the God's time right there. And God will speak to us. That's when He speaks to us. And that's when we are a little bit more able to hear us and hear Him speak to us. He speaks to us all the time, but we're too busy to hear. It takes time, and it takes a little bit of time to quiet ourselves down. It takes a long time to quiet ourselves down, you know, to quiet our minds, really. That is an experience. That's something you want to do. Maybe you do more than I do, but it's something that you want to be reminded of and to try, because our relationship with God is not how much or how many books we have read about God, you know, how much theology we know. It is how we live. It is our experience. That's most powerful. It is our experience. And for that, we need to have that willingness, that desire, that obedience, and that courage to really go maybe a little bit beyond what is so familiar or so comfortable, and just push a little bit more. So, with God's help. So I hope this will be, you know, a good experience for you. Just a couple hours here, services. I didn't even realize. You see, when you have a good time, we didn't even realize how the time goes, because I thought it was 11:30, and the nun says, no, it's 12:30.
Oh.
okay, I didn't realize it was like the morning went just like that. It was like an hour, not 4 hours. Yeah. So you see, that's a good experience to just forget about it. Yes, yeah, yeah. God doesn't measure time the way we do, and, you know, the watches and clocks. Yes. He doesn't have. That's a measure of time that we people invented for us to have structure and order and discipline, of course. It's good. Otherwise, it'll be chaos, and God is not chaos. God is order. God is discipline. God is order. Yes. All right, so the floor is open. And we only have 15 minutes. After saying what I said, then I said, you see, notice? Yes. Okay.
I appreciate your comment, Mother Hubbard. I mean, when you said, if you're not here or there, really, the essence, when you take it one step further, on that sense, you're nowhere.
You're nowhere.
I think you can ask God and say, Lord, am I overworking myself or should I work harder? I really, some of you don't know me very well, but I loathe self-analysis. God does not need our self-analysis. When you go to confession, don't analyze yourself and tell God what you don't think he knows. You just want to ask God. He's the one who knows. And so you say, Lord, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, but I don't know if I should push on or go back. And then, so that's the first thing is, like, don't try to figure it out. Don't ask, like, a certain criteria. Well, let me see, there's 7 things I'll ask. If I get 4 of them, then I'm too tired. And I've overworked myself. And don't do that kind of stuff. That's just a bunch of nonsense. But then the other thing is, you know, sort of to piggyback on what I said earlier, is like, well, look, I don't know if there's even a fact of the matter. Like, you really think there's a fact of the matter? If you're overworking or you can push yourself harder, isn't the relevant factor is like, well, I'm really tired. I'm going to go sit down in my lazy boy. Well, go do it. And take God with you. But if you're going to go to the lazy boy without God, then don't go. And if you're going to push yourself harder and just keep on pushing without God, like, well, what was the point? What are you accomplishing? But if you're going to push yourself with God, then he'll steer a moving ship. And so, again, I think it's you ask God. Don't try to figure it out yourself. And then you take God with you wherever you go. Now, having said that, I think that there, again, I'm like a broken record. I just repeat myself. But the open and closed door thing really helps is because I remember different occasions where opposite things happen. So Saturdays are long, hard days for me. This is a Saturday. One Saturday, and sometimes I get a chance to sneak home before vigil and get in my lazy boy. I was ready to go home. This has actually happened many times, but I'm leaving to go home, and I'm just about to turn the corner the way down to the St. Nectarius house where my wife and I live is right by the guest house over there. I'm about to turn the corner, and somebody pulls up in the driveway, and, oh, Father John, do you have time for a confession? Somewhere, I'm mixing a bunch of different stories up, but because this happens a lot, and on one of the occasions, I said to Mother Gabriella, well, I thought I was going to get home, but it doesn't look like it. And Mother Gabriella said, well, God knows when we need a rest. Which apparently was like, not now. But there was another time when we were supposed to have a big group of people come on the bus, and I was tired and exhausted, and I thought, well, okay, so God will give us the strength, and we'll just keep on going. And they didn't show up. I don't remember what. They didn't show up. And Mother Gabriella said, God knows when we need a rest. And that's really true. Like, it goes both ways. And sometimes God put somebody in front of you that you need to respond to. Like, so I was going into lunch today, and a young woman came up to me and said, my grandmother just died. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, I'm just going to stop and talk with her. I don't care if everybody has to wait before the food gets blessed. I just don't care, because God put this person in front of me. You have to respond to that person. But you run into somebody who's chit-chatting about Lord knows what, you think like, well, okay, I'm going to go bless the food. I'll talk to somebody. No. And so I think that there's just this kind of simple discernment that we're not always right, but if we're always offering ourselves to God and realizing that if we're going to push through, we want the strength to come from Him, and that it's perfectly okay. God's not a kind of American Protestant who has to just like, whose identity consists in the work ethic and accomplishing and progress. And like, that's just, we don't need to feel good about ourselves because we've accomplished so much. Well, you know, good to accomplish things. But so that's how I think of it. And it happens all the time. It's a very important question, because every single day we're wondering how hard to push ourselves and when to take breaks. And we feel guilty. Guilt's not a feeling, but anyways, you feel guilty about being lazy and taking a break. I don't feel guilty about taking breaks. I'm just like, not at all. God gives to us in our rest. There's plenty of work to do in life. And when you work, you work. When you rest, you rest. It may be Monday, yeah.
No, say it should just in a very simple thing that, you know, it depends. We try so hard, we work so hard, we need to check our hearts and the attitude, the reason why we would push, okay? Is it for, because I want to show, is it pride, is it ego? Or is it just the necessary things that I do? And if God calls, as Father says, you know, I thought I'm going to take a break and hear somebody, so let it be. There's an old saying in the monastic experience that says, sometimes God asks of us what we don't have, to give what we don't have. And it's that moment when you think you're done, you're tired, and somebody else comes your way, asks for something. You know you don't have it. Mothers know that. And I think, oh, and here the baby comes and, you know, wakes up when I thought it was going to be a nap. Right? And then when you look back, it says, oh, how did I do it? How did I accomplish that? And then you know it is God, it's not. So in those moments, and with that, those times, I'm just like, one more thing, or can I go one more, you know, one more hour, or one other person, or one other thing? Yeah, you say, Lord, if it's for your glory, give me the strength. But yes, I think in those times, it's just living in the world and having those, you know, environment that we live in, sometimes we need to check our heart, the reason why we would work so hard, or try to accomplish what, to prove something. That's not right, that's not good. Don't stop it. Maybe do nothing than to do that, to prove that I can do and I have done it. Okay, look how many hours I put into it. And that's probably not a good thing to really push yourself that way.
Yeah, another thing that comes to mind for me is that ideally we want to work at a pace in which we can remember God. Have remembrance of God. And I think that's a hard thing to do, and we're going to forget God a lot, and the church fathers know we forget God a lot, and we're not supposed to beat ourselves up about that. But some of it is knowing yourself. So an illustration about this is I have a little garden. I like to garden, and my attitude toward my garden can vary dramatically. So I can say, oh gosh, winter's coming, and I got to get all these things done before winter. So I have my little checklist, and I go out, and I'm just like, I got to get these things done. I got to get these things done. I got to get these done. It's just terrible experience. It's just, I can't stand it. But if I say, I have an hour, I'm going to go out and work in the garden. It turns out I get more done than I did the other way. So this is just knowing myself. Some of you are motivated differently. But if I have the garden, so I relax. I don't have the garden so that I can eat, because I like eating out of the garden, but I don't have to have it. I can go to the grocery store. If I say I have an hour, then I have a much better chance of remembering God while I'm gardening, because I'm not trying to accomplish a certain number of things, and that's not like my main focus. My main focus is just go out and enjoy God and enjoy the garden and pull some weeds, and it turns out a lot gets done. So I'm not saying that's what you need to do. I'm just saying that we can learn about ourselves and find out
the way to govern our day such that we have a heightened awareness of God, a remembrance of God, and try to live at that pace. And again, along those lines, you don't, when you realize that you've forgotten God, which is often, and now that means you've remembered that I've forgotten God, the important thing to do right then is say, Lord, thank you for reminding me of you. Don't say, oh, I can't believe it, I'm such a terrible person, I can't even think about God for 5 minutes. Well, that's, you're still not thinking about God, you're talking to yourself. Like, that's a terrible thing to do. And so, if you remember, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, God, I can't believe it, I haven't thought about God all day. Don't say that. Just say, oh, Lord, thank you, it's 2 o'clock and you reminded me. That's way better than yesterday, it wasn't until 4 yesterday. You know? And that's how it is, that's like real life, okay? And so, and St. Mark the Ascetic says, is if we would respond to God that way, he would remind us of his presence earlier and earlier and earlier. So we would remember God more and more, and then we would learn how to live at a pace. And the closer, more that we live at that pace, the more we're aware of if we're living by our own strength or living by God's strength. So,
there's a question over there. Sorry. All right, I just wanted to dive a little bit back to that. So, as you know, many of us, we might start off with the greatest of intentions of trying to help for the other, but how do we really start discerning like little signals of maybe this is too much for me, or am I really doing this for them? You know, sometimes some of us, we enjoy it so much that we're actually forgetting the message from what the others need, and then sometimes we feel so drained from doing. How do we know that we are really at the end of it, or we need to push the endurance of doing it because it's right there in front of us and we can't ignore it? Like, you know how you said some people just come to you and you're so drained, and sometimes it's just never ending, like it's one after the other, and how do you get back to that calm of knowing, did I push it too far for me, or am I pushing it for them? Because when we reach that end of the rope, we're really not much of service to anyone, even ourselves.
I know it's hard for people to believe me when I say this, but I resolutely do not ask how do you know questions. I just don't ask those questions. Like, the scripture doesn't ask those questions. Apart from the first epistle of John, they don't ask how you know questions. That's the only exception. They just don't ask how do you know questions. You just do it.
You just do it.
You do it or don't do it. And you say, Lord, I'm at my wit's end. If I try to help this person, I'm going to take their head off. I've been in that situation a lot of times. And I've taken people's heads off. Yeah. It's like, better to go. Maybe they're not going to like you, and maybe they think that you should have time for them, but they don't know the alternative. They don't know what's going on inside. And maybe you're wrong about yourself, but like, you know, it's like, God's a God of freedom and love, and he wants us to choose. And so you just say, Lord, this, maybe I could go more, but it just doesn't feel like it. It's,
so more important is cutting the questions and second-guessing yourself.
Yeah, I don't do that. Well, that's what how do you know questions do, is they just invite the second-guessing, and they completely short-circuit any real genuine relationship with God. It's me trying to figure things out, and how do you know means, like, well, give me the criteria, and I'll see if I hit 3 of the 5, and that's just like, that's non-relational. And it completely circumvents freedom. You know, give me an algorithm. Well, that's not freedom. Now, there are some, one other thing that I thought of while you were talking is that, well, there's people who, I hope, there's people that are close to you who can say, you know, you're overdoing it. My wife has said that to me on more than one occasion. But sometimes she tells me, time to go. Yeah, Mother did tell me a version of what she just said, too. One time when people came and I was on my way home, she said, let's see if I can remember the exact quote. She said, sometimes when we don't have any more to give, God brings someone along so that we can know that, and I don't quite know how it goes, but we know that what we do comes from him, not from us. But, like, that's a discernment. And it's not like God's going to upset at you if you say, like, no, I got to go home. But if you, like, plow through, then suddenly you get that sense of, like, oh, yeah, God did it.
Sorry, people want answers to questions which seem to me just the wrong questions to ask. And I've spent a good bit of my life doing that, and so I understand it, I get it. But the how do you know question is, to me, one of those questions that just leads us down the wrong path.
I think the world kind of gives us that distraction.
Oh, absolutely.
Away from that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's a natural thing living in
the world. It all started with basically the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, where knowledge became Trump issue, and like that Trump card, and we have to know things that we just don't know. Like, we don't know these things. The Christian life is a life of massive uncertainty. It's just massive uncertainty, massive vulnerability, massive fragility. And we do everything in our power to make it certain and solid and whatever the opposite of vulnerable is. I don't know, it's so secure and this whole thing. That's not how it is. The Christian life is supposed to be filled with uncertainty, fragility, and vulnerability. God's power is perfected in our weakness. Why are we trying so hard to become strong? God's power, God's knowledge is perfected in our uncertainty. I mean, we're striving after the wrong things. We're striving after the worldly values. And say, isn't it much more humble to say, like, Lord, I have no idea if I should help this person. Like, I'm totally spent, but they're really needy. Like, I have no idea what to do. I'm throwing myself upon you. Whatever happens, happens. Like, that's way better than trying to figure out what God to do.
When you're praying just by yourself personally, how often do you do a structured prayer, for example, like the Lord's Prayer versus just saying something unstructured, like, oh God, these trees are so beautiful?
Father Roman was quite big on the latter. He's like, using our own words and talking to God. Yeah, I don't think I want to answer for myself what I do, but... what I think is that both are important within private prayer and then also the prayer of the church, because the prayers of let's call it the prayers of the prayer book, okay? And as well as the prayers in the church, really teach us how to pray. And if we pray those, then when we pray in our own words, we find ourselves starting to use some of those phrases. Same thing when we read the scripture, we might be using. So that's kind of influencing. But if we just pray the prayers of the church, well, we're not going to pray them 24/7, okay? So we want to, maybe I'll have a time of morning prayer, evening prayer, whatever, but you want to be able to pray throughout the day and with your own words, and you want to be able to be responsive and react to God. So I think, both are important. I will say this, I guess I'll just to illustrate this. So I'm sorry. I shouldn't do things like this, but anyway. So I'm dyslexic, okay? So I don't read very well. And so normal is that you spend 15% of your mental energy decoding the words on the page and 85% analyzing. And for me, it's reversed. I spend 85% decoding, even if it's totally familiar text, and 15% synthesizing, analyzing, reflecting. So I cannot pray while reading the book. I have the services memorized, except for a couple of prayers here and there. I do it. Even prayers that I pray out of a prayer book, I pray by memory. Because I can pray them. And if I read them, I can't pray because all of my mental energy is just decoding the words. So for me, I'm much more bent toward praying more freely, or whatever, and when I do the prayers that are in the prayer book, they tend to be the ones I can memorize. But this is like wildly, in my view, it's wildly individual and relational for each person. It's different and different times and different seasons of your life. And, really, you should be answering this, not me, because you have way more.
It is important that you have moments of prayer, then nothing else but prayer.
Yes.
You just stand in the corner of the icon or whatever, there's prayer time. And then throughout the day, as you said, you take a walk, and you still pray, or can be simply prayer, is praising God and noticing God and meditating on God and saying the Jesus prayer. So both are important. And as Father was saying, the best thing is those prayers are standard. Morning prayers, and evening prayers, basically, and the other prayers, the prayer of the hour during the day, they are the same. It's good to memorize a few prayers. And because by repetition we memorize, and once you memorize, you pray better. I say the same thing as Father. The prayers that I know by heart is how I pray best, because I can just pray without, But then there are canons, there are other longer prayers that always you do use them. And those how we learn how to pray, and takes a little bit of effort, and It's okay, but both are necessary, absolutely necessary. But yeah, Father Roman would say again, the elders, it's again an old saying, if you pray only when you pray, you'll never pray. Sure, now it's time to pray. I'm going to read automatically, mechanically, and read all your prayers. I'm done, I'm set, and go and forget about it. That's not prayer either. It's not the best way to pray either, but definitely a few moments of prayer, but doing just that are very important. It's different than when you go along and you talk to God and you say a prayer and you memorize or repeat a verse from the psalm, and whatever. So those are beautiful. That this is how we make our, you know, that we pray constantly. And that's the goal. And then, you know, staying anchored in God with our minds and God in that way. But otherwise, sure, why would we go to church, you know? If I pray all day, I don't have to go to church. Well, it's different. And it's community. And don't forget, again, as I said in the beginning, a little bit more, you have to remember that we're members of the same body and I need to do my part and my share. The whole body suffers if I don't do my part. That's where we need to be. And prepare for even the prayers that we do, you know, our prayer life during the day, every day of the week, is even a preparation for coming together as a prayer for community on Sunday. Well, feast days when we come to pray in church as a community. So if I don't pray at all, I'm not prepared to go and pray with the others, but I do anyway. But you just have to be aware of that. So our personal prayer role is a responsibility also, as if for the rest of the community, that I do my part, my share, bringing my contribution to the community, to the body of Christ. Yeah.
As you walk your path with Christ, what is the most unusual lesson you've learned that you'd like to pass on to others?
God surprises me all the time. I think I'm going to do this and I don't get it done until 3 months later because God had put something else in front of me. That's my experience, I think, because God throughout my life. I went to the monastery and I thought, Lord, this is beautiful, that's where I want to be buried. Well, 4 years later, I'm someplace else, and then I just so comfortable in that monastery. I said, oh, that's nice. Okay, now I can just relax, right? And God says, oh, pick up and go. I have another place here. Okay, just learn. Yes, but that's my experience. I don't know that I have to, yes. Be ready for whatever God puts in front of me. I don't say that I sometimes struggle with it. I don't, but I have to.
I don't know about the most, but one thing that stands out that I am happy to pass on to others is related to this geographical space that we're in. Some of you were probably here before this was a conference room, and there was the old pole barn here, and where we used to have liturgy. So this is all nice and new and pleasant, but the old pole barn was nice and old and pleasant. And we'd still come in the same places. This was where the nave was. This is roughly where the iconostasis was, and where the St. Andrew Chapel is on the other side of this wall is roughly where the altar area was. And I came here I started here in the spring of 2009, and I had just been ordained a priest, so I knew even less then than I know now. And it was a Saturday morning, in fact, and it was in July, and I was pretty tired of making mistakes. So I was standing right kind of over there near where we kept the censer, and Father Roman was standing for some reason. And I went over to him and I said, Father Roman, how do you stop thinking about what the people out there in the nave are thinking about you? How do you stop thinking about what other people are thinking about you? Which is what most of us do most of the time. We're thinking about what other people are thinking about us. That's called vainglory, what it's worth, but we're thinking about what other people are thinking about us. And Father Roman said, oh, Father, nobody's thinking about you. Okay, it was right over there. Okay, but I'll never forget it. And then, Father Roman always, like 90+% of the time, would make some statement like that to me. And then there would be this pause during which I would have my thoughts. And in this case, my thoughts were, well, that's just crazy, because on the other side of that account of sasas, there's a bunch of people there, and we're about to start liturgy, and I'm about to start making mistakes, and they know what like and so I'm that's not true. So what you said is not true. And then so after he gave me time to have my thoughts, he said, the only person looking at you is God. And he looks at you from within your heart. So the only person who looks at you, looking at you within your heart. Yeah, so that was kind of surprising to me. And that's the sort of thing I would probably like to pass on. But it took me years to sort of figure out what was really going on. Because, I was actually reading St. John Chrysostom's commentary once when I realized what Father Roman meant. To me is that so Jesus says that there's going to come a time in which the sun and the moon are going to go dark. Okay, when he comes back, there's going to go dark. And St. John Chrysostom says, he says that in fact, the sun doesn't go out. It doesn't go dark. It's that Christ's return is so bright you don't notice the sun. Okay. So when at the second coming, according to St. John Chrysostom, Christ is so bright, the sun's just like it always is, but you don't see it, you don't notice it, because Christ is so bright. Well, why do I say all that? Because then it finally hit me what Father Roman meant. Christ is so bright in our hearts that we don't even notice who's looking at us. The point isn't that nobody's looking at us. The point is that we don't care, because the light of Christ is so bright within us that we don't notice those things that are going on outside of us. And so I sort of belabored that too long. But that's one of a handful of gifts that Father Roman gave me. And if I had to pass it on, I would, because vainglory is like the problem of our, one of the problems of our age. And it's really insidious. And so you just have to remember that God's looking at you from within your heart. And that light is brighter than any light outside of you. You're trying to get us to go. Oh, no, you're trying to get us.
In this day and age of humanism, how do we walk the tightrope between being at peace with everyone and also standing true to our Orthodox faith in the face of people who might want to compromise, say, with other traditions, other religions, and get us to abandon ours?
Embrace martyrdom. The scriptures tell us to rejoice when we're persecuted. Now you don't go out and like be a obnoxious know-it-all. St. Paul doesn't say to be at peace with all men. He says it's as much as it's up to you, as much as it's possible to be at peace with all men. You can't control the other person. If they want to slap you in the face, they can slap you in the face, but you just don't have to slap them back. Okay. And so I think that I'm dead serious. You know, the Beatitudes are a ladder. They start with poverty of spirit. You can explain how each one goes. The capstone of the Beatitudes is persecution. And that comes right after being a peacemaker, because people are going to reject you if you want to be a peacemaker, not a peacekeeper, but a peacemaker. And so then you can like go down the ladder backwards. And so I think that there's a sort of strange problem in Orthodox. I hear people say, you know, like, oh, I can't believe it, John, First Amendment rights. I should be able to say what I want. I'm like, First Amendment rights. Stand before the judgment seat. So I have my First Amendment rights, God. So I have something to say here. No, you don't need First Amendment rights. So if you say something, you get persecuted for it. Don't say, I have First Amendment rights. Say, rejoice and be glad. Great is your Lord in heaven. And so you just live the Christian life. You don't beat up people. You just live the Christian life. You take what comes your way and you rejoice.
So,
pardon
me? It's safe for many. You're not going to convince them, so.
No, that's up to God and their willingness. And again, I think it's good to walk away in those contexts where you think you're causing more problems. But it's not. But we don't want to walk away because we're afraid. We want to do what's best for that person, and that's the person in front of us. And usually arguing is not what's best for them, you know, or condemning or harshness or forgiveness. But you know, saying that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the Living God, that's a good thing to tell.
Can you touch on, you mentioned earlier, what vainglory is and some general practices to avoid it?
Glory is when someone looks at you and sees someone else, namely Christ. Okay, so when Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Okay, so he was going by the Father. The Mother of God said, my soul magnifies the Lord, which means when you look at the Mother of God, you don't see her, you see Christ. Okay? And when Jesus said, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit, he said, I glorify the Father, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit, and he's going to glorify me. He does this Holy. So we never glorify ourselves, we glorify someone else. And what does that mean? That means when somebody looks at us, they see someone else. Okay? So that's what normal glory is. Okay? And so to glorify somebody means I'm a window to someone else, ultimately to Christ and God. Right? So vainglory is basically when people look at me and they see me. Okay? And when I live my life in such a way that I want people to see me. And so there's worldly vainglory and spiritual vainglory. And worldly vainglory is like, I want to be really smart and clever. I want to be really funny. I want to, you know, dress in such a way or look, you know, draw attention to myself in whatever the world values. Okay? Might be smart, might be money, might be reputation, it might be clothes, might be good looks, might whatever. Okay? And then spiritual vainglory is, you know, kind of the Pharisee kind of thing. It's like, well, I go into church and nobody's there, so I just kind of like mosey around and venerate and I get here and there. But now there's 10 people there and I go in and I bow 3 times and I do everything exactly and perfectly. Well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is I want people to think I'm spiritual. Well, that's vainglory. Okay? And so if we do our spiritual activity in such a way that we're drawing attention to ourselves, well, that's spiritual vainglory. It's being pharisaical. And Jesus tells us how to combat this in the first third of the sixth chapter of Matthew, Gospel of Matthew. He says, you can give alms before other people in such a way that everybody knows that you're an alms giver, and then now you've already got your reward. That's vainglory. But give alms, give them in secret so that nobody knows. Let them know what you're doing. Pray, you can pray in the street corner, everybody knows you're praying, or you can go in the closet and shut the door and pray. And same thing with fasting. So one way, there's other ways to combat vainglory, but Jesus' suggestion is we do things in secret. Okay? So like one rule is like don't ever do in church something more pious than what you do in your prayer corner. Because why would you do it? Well, because you want people to think you're pious. So basically, you do things in secret, and you don't do anything to draw attention to yourself. You know, you go to a place where everybody kneels on Sunday during the gospel. Well, that doesn't seem to be quite right. But you kneel on Sunday during the gospel because you're only like, you know, he's the only guy who stands up. You only draw attention to yourself. You just do that. And so, whatever it is, you know, you blend in the crowd, because if God's in you, then you want him to be the one who shines forth, not you. So you try to do live your life as kind of outwardly mundane and uninteresting as possible. You want to be like a perfectly vanilla person outside, but inside you want to be filled with Christ and light, and then that will come out because somebody will come up and pounce on your foot or, you know, insult you or do whatever, and then you'll react differently. Because Christ is light inside you, and then that will manifest not you, but Christ. That's why Jesus said, you're the light of the world, let your light shine before others in such a way that they see your good works and give glory to God. They look at you and they saw that response, they say, well, he couldn't do that. That couldn't have been from him. That must have been the work of God. That's all he means. And so, yeah. Live a simple life and let God shine through when he wants to. Don't try to do it yourself. One more.
What did you mean by guilt isn't a feeling?
Oh, Lord have mercy. it's not a feeling. The first person that I've been able to find that calls it a feeling is Darwin in 1887 in his book on the sentiments of man and animals. Nowhere in scripture is guilt a feeling. Nowhere in Plato or Aristotle is guilt a feeling. Nowhere in Patristics is guilt a feeling. Nowhere in the Triodians is guilt a feeling. Guilt's a fact. You robbed the bank or you didn't. You lied or you didn't. If you look in Webster's dictionary, the first one is 1827 or 1822 or 3 or something like that. In fact, look, just you can get it online. Just look. Guilt's a fact. It doesn't matter what the jury said. The jury said you were innocent, but in fact you were guilty. It's just a fact. It's not what people know. It's not how you feel. Nothing like that. And that's true, right? The actual Webster doesn't change until the 60s. But the guilt starts getting called a feeling. And Darwin, there must be antecedents, but I can't find them. But they're not in Hume, for example. And Hume built his whole philosophy on sentiments, and that's only 100 years before Darwin. And so goes from Darwin to Nietzsche, and from Nietzsche to Freud, and who's that other psychologist that Jordan Peterson likes so much? What?
Jung.
Yeah, Jung. And then it's everywhere. Once it's in Freud and Jung, it's everywhere. Okay, and then this famous woman, anthropologist, who was hired by the government, U.S. government, to explain why in heck we don't understand the Japanese. Like, why do we not understand the Japanese? Like, we just don't get them. This was during World War II, 1940s. And she wrote, she was doing her work on Native American cultures, and she wrote this document for the U.S. government, CIA, to explain why we don't get the Japanese, and that's developed this culture of fear, culture of it's a guilt culture, shame culture, and fear culture, but nobody ever talks about fear culture. And the reason we really don't understand the Japanese is because they have a shame culture and we have a guilt culture, okay? All of that's brand new terminology. Within the last 150 years, all of that brand new. That was in the 1940s, and so that's 90 years old. All of that's brand new. And I think it's very problematic for us to understand in our Christian life because the operative word is shame. Shame is the feeling, shame is the proper, normal feeling when you sin, you want to hide. Adam and Eve hid after they sinned. And when you go to confession, the priest says, "Behold, my child, so-and-so, Christ stands here invisibly receiving your confession." Christ stands here invisibly receiving your confession. Do not be ashamed or afraid. Conceal nothing. Come out from behind the tree. Don't hide behind words. As not a single word in the prayer is about guilt. Okay? So I could talk for hours on this because it's really a big mess. And we've just absorbed it lock, stock, and barrel. But it's not a part of our tradition. It's not a part of anybody's tradition. Atheist, Hindu, Buddhist, nothing. Until late 1800s. Yeah. So think about shame. Don't think about guilt. Think about shame. Don't think about guilt. And there's bad shame, too. There's toxic shame. There's bad times. Not all shame is good shame, but... it's a really good book, but he doesn't get the, you know, I think about it differently.
So is anyone interested in the gift shop before you leave? Yes? Okay. All right. Then I'll make sure Sister
Openstein.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for speaking to us.